Strangers and Aliens, Episode 47, Into the Silent Planet, brought to you by Audible.com. Get a free audiobook download at www.audibletrial.com/strangers. Over 100,000 titles to choose from for your iPhone, Android, Kindle, or MP3 player, including the book we are discussing today, Out of the Silent Planet by C.S. Lewis. Get a free book by C.S. Lewis, J.R.R. Tolkien, or more by going to audibletrial.com/strangers. And thank you for your support.
Welcome to the Strangers and Aliens podcast.
Strangers. To boldly say what needs to be said.
Would you be a stranger or an alien? Or would you be a strange alien?
The truth is out there. I am your father's best friend's plumber. Superman.
Wonder Woman.
Heroes. Villains. Captain Picard versus Captain Kirk.
Do you think that there's room in sci-fi for God? The very first thing that God did was that he created something, so we have a creative God.
This is Strangers and Aliens Podcast.
Hello and welcome back to Strangers and Aliens. I'm Ben Avery.
And I'm Steve McDonald.
And we are Strangers and Aliens. We're both a little bit of both, I think. What do you think, Steve?
Yeah, I'd say so.
Okay. Kind of have to. Because what else are you going to say? No?
No. Yeah. I'm definitely a stranger, not an alien. Well, I mean the other way around.
Yeah. See, it just doesn't work. Okay. So, my goal this year is to do at least one episode every week. And not to overload you with lots and lots of episodes, which I'm just going to stop right there and not say anything more about anybody else who might be doing that in other podcasts.
Whoever but, that may be.
Yeah. But I am going to say that this week we decided to go ahead and post two. We'll do that every once in a while, but it won't be too often. And when we do, it will normally be a shorter episode. This episode, Steve, are you ready for this episode?
I am as ready as I can be, seeing that I have misplaced the book and haven't looked at it recently. But yes, ready to go.
Don't give the audience too much confidence, you know? We're going to be talking about C.S. Lewis's science fiction classic, Out of the Silent Planet.
Yes.
I wish I could have some sort of echo effect right there, but...
Planet.
That's nice.
You can mix that in post.
I'm not going to mess with it. Out of the Silent Planet is one of C.S. Lewis's popular books, and honestly, with C.S. Lewis, his books are either really popular, kind of popular, or no one cares. at least that's the way I've kind of seen it. We're reading it this month for the 2013 year of C.S. Lewis. And we are reading Out of the Silent Planet for the month of February. We are also talking about it on Goodreads. We have a Goodreads group. Steve, are you on it? Are you
not
in
yet.
Goodreads?
Not yet.
Why not?
It's a little complicated.
What's complicated?
Well, I have other people who are on Goodreads as well.
Uh-huh.
And I know. And I'm not sure of the culture of it. So I don't want to get into it and then have all my friends be like, oh, good, you're on Goodreads too. And then, you know, hype it up and everything. And then have me sort of be like overloaded with this culture of Goodreads that I didn't know was actually there.
Just don't accept any friendship from anyone. Except me. And then you'll
be fine.
Well,
that's the thing. There's people who I would have to accept the friendship of.
No. You get on there and you just flat out don't even look at any friend requests except for me.
Yes, sir.
Don't even look at them. Don't even bother with them. and then join this group.
I'll see what I can do.
Yeah. You better.
Yes, sir.
We're also going to put a post on our blog, though, so we can talk about it on there too. How does that sound?
Okay.
All right. So on Goodreads, we are talking a little bit about Out of the Silent Planet. I'm noticing a lot of people who have not read this book by C.S. Lewis, even though many Christians, especially fans of genre type things, are big fans of C.S. Lewis. Mm-hmm. So in this episode, we're going to consider this an introduction to Out of the Silent Planet. And we're not going to spoil the book. However, if you have read the book, you still are going to get some information, I think, out of this episode that you might not have known before. We're not experts. Again, we don't want to give you too much confidence in our in our stylings.
No, or we should not do that.
But we are fans of C.S. Lewis, and I am a big fan of C.S. Lewis. I'm a big fan of his space trilogy. I really enjoy especially Perelandra, which is the second in the series. So I am excited that there are a lot of people who are reading this book for the first time and who have never picked it up, but are reading it now because we've been suggesting it. So that's exciting. Right. And I'm glad to see that. So consider this some foundational information as you are diving into this kind of unique book in C.S. Lewis's oeuvre. Did I use that word right?
No, but I don't think anyone uses it correctly. So
I don't even know what it means, but it sounds nice.
I think it's oeuvre.
Oeuvre?
Oeuvre, yeah. Okay. Like genre.
Okay, I'm saying it wrong, but am I using it right?
Yeah, it means someone's complete body of work.
There we go.
Yeah.
That's what I was hoping for. So, without any further ado... Wait, not adieu. That's French for goodbye. Without any further ado, I think we should start talking about this book. What do you think?
Let's do it.
Because what are you going to say? No?
Yeah, I know. I'd rather talk about the holiday special.
Let's talk about anything other than what you plan to talk about for this episode.
I'm hijacking this episode.
So.
Gremlins.
Gremlins. We should talk about Gremlins sometime.
Yeah.
That's a good movie to talk about. Not necessarily a good movie, but a good movie to talk about.
I would have to have watched it at some point.
That also would help. If you're going to talk about it anyway.
Yeah, good. So,
well, let's talk about some of the influences behind this book and some of the reasons why C.S. Lewis chose to write this book. Mm-hmm. Let's first put it in some historical context. C.S. Lewis was born in 1898, and he, when he was about 21, wrote a book of poetry called Spirits in Bondage. Before he wrote that book, he did start writing a poem that was actually kind of about space and about powers in space that like resided in planets and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. But he never really got very far with that. Let's see, 1926, he wrote Dimer, which is a narrative poem. Again, it's one of those things where, you know, with C.S. Lewis, it's either really popular, kind of popular, or no one cares. And that's kind of where Dimer falls. That was 1926. Again, you know, all this is happening before he was C.S. Lewis.
Right.
With the reverb. But don't do it, Steve. Let's see. Let's skip to 1931. That is when he was talking with his friends, J.R.R. Tolkien, and another friend named Dyson, and they were having a conversation, and it was through these conversations about myths and about the resonance of myth within humanity that they were kind of able to push him over the edge as far as accepting that Jesus was real and then accepting Jesus as a part of his life and his worldview. In 1933, he wrote his first prose fiction book called The Pilgrim's Regress, which is one that I do recommend. It's, again, one of those no one cares because it's basically a Pilgrim's Progress type of book where it's a character wandering from one metaphorical thing to another. The metaphor, however, being his own life, coming more from his personal life in some ways and then some theological and philosophical discussions he's had with different people, and these different ideas are represented by, you know, giants and you know, creatures and different right. things like that.
Very much like Pilgrim's Progress.
Yeah, it's exactly like that style. I mean, it's meant to be strict allegory, one-to-one right. allegory. If you see something in the book, it has a real-life doppelganger in his life. In 1936, he wrote a book called Allegory of Love. And then right after that, he had a conversation with J.R.R. Tolkien. And I actually need to read this quote directly, because this is actually from the letters of J.R.R. Tolkien. And this is really interesting. And it's this conversation they had which really set the course for Christian literature for almost the last 100 years. Tolkien and Lewis were talking about things that they wanted to read. And Tolkien said that Lewis once said to him, "There's too little of what we really like in stories, and that they ought to write some themselves." So this is Tolkien speaking. "We agreed that he should try space travel, and I should try time travel. When C.S. Lewis and I tossed up, and he was to write on space travel and I on time travel, I began an abortive book of time travel, of which the end was to be the presence of my hero in the drowning of Atlantis." Ooh. Now, J.R.R. Tolkien did not write his Atlantis book, but C.S. Lewis did get his imagination captured and wrote Out of the Silent Planet. 1938, Out of the Silent Planet comes out. It's his first actual real book of fiction. After that, you have 1941 with Screwtape, 1943 with Paralandra, 1945 That Hideous Strength. There's the trilogy, Paralandra and That Hideous Strength being the second and third books in the trilogy. 1946, The Great Divorce. 1947, Miracles. And it wasn't until 1950 that he wrote The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. And 1952 is when Mere Christianity came out, based on lectures that he gave during World War II. And those lectures that he gave during World War II are in a lot of ways what kind of turned him from C.S. Lewis into C.S. Lewis. So Out of the Silent Planet was written, it was his first novel. It was his first, like, real work of fiction. And it got pretty good reviews and everything, all things considered. So that's where it lies in his body of work. Which is, it's interesting then, because you're not just reading a science fiction novel by one of the greatest Christian thinkers and writers of the 20th century. But you're also, when you're reading Out of the Silent Planet, kind of a first, his first outing. I would have loved to have been that conversation with C.S. Lewis and Tolkien where they were talking about, let's do this. Hey, we should write about what we like. What do you like? I kind of like space travel. Okay, do it, you know. And I like time travel. Do it. And a Tolkien time travel novel. Imagine that. Now, I awesome. Do think that after that is when he started getting into writing The Hobbit. So some of those concepts that he was coming up with as he was thinking about time travel may have been as he's developing Middle Earth, you know, coming up, because with Middle Earth, he was trying to develop a mythology for England.
Right.
But yeah, so we got this book from C.S. Lewis. So that's kind of where it fits in the timeline as far as his writings go. There is one writing I left out of there, and that is from about 1904 when he was 6 years old. He wrote a chapter in his Boxen series. Now, his Boxen series were writings that C.S. Lewis did as a child about an anthropomorphic society that has been published. I actually do not have a copy of this and have never read a copy of this. I don't know anything about this. But he wrote a chapter in there called To Mars and Back, which is interesting because that's what Out of the Silent Planet is. Yeah. It's To Mars and Back. It's influenced there by, well, let's just get into some of the things that influenced him outside of his own desires and interests. When he was a kid, he read a lot. And H.G. Wells and Jules Verne were two authors that he really, really liked. Steve, can you think of any books from H.G. Wells that might have influenced what he's doing here with Out of the Silent Planet?
War of the Worlds.
Yes.
I think probably was the, you know, that nugget where he started to say to himself, you know, wow, you know, a different race from a different planet. what if that were transposed? What if we, you know, we had a representative go to that planet and probably kicking it around saying, well, okay, the malevolence of the planet has already been plumbed with, you know, John Carter and some other books there. But, you know, just saying, turning it around, you know, turning it on its ear and saying, what if it were good? You know, what if this was like the perfect planet instead of, you know, an evil being from an evil planet coming to our planet, you know, us going to this perfect planet. Now we're the evil represented there, but in a completely different way, not as a malevolent conquering force, but as this thing that is discovering how evil it actually is, you know, discovering our innate evil.
So yeah, War of the Worlds and Out of the Solar Planet are definitely like a mirror image of each other. There's one other book by H.G. Wells that really, really, really influenced Out of the Silent Planet, and that is First Men in the Moon, which is another book that C.S. Lewis would have read early on in his life and would have enjoyed early on in his life. It's about the first men to go to the moon. It's one of those that you get what you pay for. The title, it tells you what it is, all right? Yeah. It's like, you know, Out of the Silent Planet and The First Man in the Moon. It's like the difference between the sci-fi Christian and Strangers and Aliens, you know? One just tells you right what it is, and the other one, you got to kind of puzzle about it for a little bit. And
there's
maybe
a bush
read,
to be around.
Read the back of the book and see what it's like.
Yeah.
So, anyway, that was a big influence on it as well, and we'll talk about how big of an influence in a moment. There was another book called Voyage to Arcturus by David Lindsay.
Mm-hmm.
It was written in the 1920s. C.S. Lewis read it in 1935,
right,
which you will remember was before his conversation with Tolkien about what he would like to write about. And Voyage to Arcturus, again, you can definitely see the influence of that book all over Out of the Silent Planet. Voyage to Arcturus, have you read it, Steve?
I have, yes.
How long ago? Do you remember much?
I remember it was really trippy.
It's a, I honestly, I was watching Twin Peaks while I was listening, not right at the same time, but during the time period that I was listening to the audiobook Voyage to Arcturus while I was cleaning at my church. So I'd be scrubbing toilets and listening to this thing, or straightening chairs in the sanctuary and listening to this thing. I'm also then, when I get home, getting ready to go to bed, watch an episode of Twin Peaks. Wow. David Lynch, you know, who's just known for the weird.
Mm-hmm.
They go well together. Voyage to Arcturus is a philosophical science romance, or a fantasy romance kind of thing. And I'm not using romance in the term, you know, like a lovey-dovey kind of thing, but in the literary sense,
right,
where you have a character who leaves one world, our world, and goes to another world with two other people. When he gets there, he gets separated from those other two people and goes on this basic journey of discovery where he's actually becoming alien when he goes from place to place and meets different people who have like a third eye, and then he'll eat something and it'll give him a third eye or whatever. I mean, I'm kind of jumbling things together here. But the bottom line is every person he meets is another philosophical attitude about life and about the world and about what's right and what's wrong and all these kind of things. And they're just warped, weird things. For example, every single person he meets, or almost every single person he meets, it's almost like a drinking game kind of thing where you take a drink every time this happens, they die. Like, it almost got funny as I'm getting towards the end. I'm like, oh my goodness. He meets this person and I'm thinking in my mind, oh, when's this guy gonna kick it? And then a little bit later, a rock falls on the guy or something.
Yeah.
Every single person he gets to dies. He's leaving this wake of death in his path. And he gets to the end of the book. We're in the next to last chapter. And this one character you spent the entire time with, who's learning about life and learning about the universe and learning about this God and that God and who's the God of life and who's the God of death and who wants this and who wants that. And he finally meets up with one of the two people he came with. And it turns out this whole kind of conspiracy thing where that guy was actually doing this to kind of trick people and to like tip the scales of this kind of battle thing in his favor. And he dies. The main character dies. Spoilers to a 100-year-old book. That no one's going to read, by the way, because I do not recommend reading it.
No.
So I don't mind spoiling it. He dies next to last chapter. In the last chapter, you find out the third character who disappeared at the beginning of the book and who you haven't seen until the final chapter. He and the main character are the same person.
Right.
Yeah. I don't know how this works. There's no exclamation for it. It's just they're the same person. And we're just going to go with that. And then that's the end of the book.
Right.
It's David Lynch. Totally David Lynch.
It could be if he worked in space.
He did work in space, actually. He did Dune.
Right.
Okay, so that kind of thing, though, where you have the character on this alien landscape, and it is a very alien landscape in Voyage to Arcturus, and he's traveling and meeting people. You see that in Out of the Silent Planet. In fact, Lewis himself, he wrote in a letter to Ruth Pitter in 1947, so it's after he wrote Out of the Silent Planet, he said, "From Lindsay, I first learned what other planets in fiction were really good for spiritual adventures." And so it was that Voyage to Arcturus that informed that idea. You also see, like I said, from the first Men in the Moon with H.G. Wells, it has the same basic setup as Out of the Silent Planet. Mm-hmm. They both take place kind of off in the countryside in England. And they both have people building a rocket on their own that's going to go into space that is a sphere shape. And they both have a person who is not planning and not a part of the planning who ends up accidentally or part of the plan to go to the moon for First Men on the Moon, or to Mars for Out of the Silent Planet. Now, in Out of the Silent Planet, there's a little more drama to it than there is in First Men on the Moon. But it's that same kind of setup. You can almost see, like C.S. Lewis, he's writing the book, and okay, so I'll have the setup from First Men on the Moon to get them in the rocket and get them into space. But when they get to the planet, it turns into Voyage to Arcturus. So now there were... There were a couple other writers that C.S. Lewis was responding to with his book here. Olaf Stapledon and J.B.S. Haldane, who were both not big fans of Christianity. Haldane hated Christianity. Stapledon just thought it was not at all an important part of human history. And they both had writings that were just offensive to Christian ideals. I mean, it just, C.S. Lewis said one of the reasons why he wanted to write the book, and this is again from one of his letters, he said, "My Out of the Silent Planet has no factual basis and is a critique of our own age, only as any Christian work is implicitly a critique of any age. I was trying to redeem, for genuinely imaginative purposes, the form popularly known in this country as science fiction, just as Hamlet redeemed the popular revenge play." So there you get into some of his influences and some of his motivations.
So it's like Space Hamlet.
Except it has nothing to do with Hamlet.
No. But still, wouldn't that be cool? Space Hamlet!
Yeah. You know what would be cool is Space Tempest. Oh, wait.
Yeah, why don't they ever do that?
They should do that. Except you know for who would, like, you know who three would or four be great? Times already. You know who'd be great in that? Leslie Nielsen. He'd be awesome.
But before he was like a goofball, funny guy.
For Space Tempest. And for anyone who doesn't know what we're talking about the classic science fiction movie, Forbidden Planet.
Forbidden Planet!
So let's talk about some other influences that show up in the Space Trilogy and in Out of the Silent Planet. Here's one. How about this, Steve? Okay. The Bible.
Well, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, as much as any Christian fiction has the Bible as its ultimate base.
Well, it goes a little further than that, though, Steve. Because there's a whole mythology behind Out of the Silent Planet. This whole mythology of the universe. And it's not allegorical. It's like Aslan, where in Narnia, Aslan is Jesus in as much as he's the Son of God. And he's that part of the Trinity made flesh for the people of Narnia, who are talking animals. And right. So he comes in the form of a lion. And in Out of the Silent Planet and Paralandra and That Hideous Strength, you have these named entities that are not just allegory, but they are meant to be who they are. There's the Old One, and there is, you know, the Son of the Old One. I mean, they're meant to be God. They're meant to be the Son of God. And you have angels, right. And you have devils. And so you have the whole idea of where Lucifer, you know, the story of Lucifer is a big part of the story of the space trilogy.
Right.
He's cast from heaven and cast down where he becomes, you know, the ruler of our world.
Right.
And so that's a very, very specific and important part of the world view and the world of the space trilogy. So yes, it goes a little bit deeper than just being the foundation, as because he's a Christian writer writing Christian fiction. There's also the character of Ransom. And Steve, you know who he is based on, don't you? Or who we think he's based on. No?
Maybe. Say it and then I'll...
Well, Ransom is a philologist, and he knows and studies language.
Who could it be?
He's based on J.R.R. Tolkien.
Yeah.
That's what some people think, and some people say, no, he's not. And so C.S. Lewis said that it actually wasn't based on Tolkien. He made the character a philologist because that made it easier for him to learn the language when he gets there. Because that whole classic idea of you have to see him learning the language, which happens all over the place in science fiction. It's there in this book, but for the book, he's like taking delight in learning the language. Oh, I just learned a verb. Oh, so it's a silent H after C, you know.
Yeah.
That kind of thing. But
that's funny.
I do like the idea of this character being based on Tolkien because he also likes to hike and that kind of thing.
Yeah, I liked Ransom just initially because he had a last name that meant something.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, growing up, you know, reading certain things, you get to get used to names meaning something. So all of a sudden you're just like, oh, Ransom. I sort of know what's going to happen to this character.
The only problem with that is that it's not his real name. It's a pseudonym.
Right.
Because of the style of this book takes, which is, this is Ransom's story as written by his friend, C.S. Lewis.
Right.
And so, in fact, C.S. Lewis appears as a character, and, you know, it's that's a style that happened a lot in especially right. older books, but he appears as a character in both Out of the Silent Planet and Paralandra. They had to change names so that you couldn't know who Ransom actually was because of his connection to the two bad guys in the book, Divine and Weston. And they didn't want, in the context of this fictional book, they didn't want anyone to know who Weston really was and who Divine really was.
Right.
So. Now, testament to that is that he actually got letters from readers who were asking him if the book was actually true. And in fact, after he died, someone connected with C.S. Lewis got a letter from a 13-year-old girl asking him if she could have Ransom's real name and address so she could write him a letter complimenting him on his writing style. So there's yet another connection to War of the Worlds, when you have people believing that it actually might be true. Of course, no one believed the book War of the Worlds was true because obviously Earth wasn't invaded by Martians when the book came out. However, people did with the radio program believe that Martians were actually invading. And so people thought that man went to Mars because of C.S. Lewis's vivid, vivid descriptions and the letters at the end of the book where he talks to Ransom and explains how he's going to write the book. So yes, Ransom does have a meaning, does have a purpose. I mean, the name definitely fits the character.
Right. You know, and before you know, you know, that much about him, that's the name of the character. I mean, he's Ransom for all intents and purposes.
He's a good character, too. He's active. He's proactive. He doesn't necessarily want to get involved, but does when he has to. Mm-hmm. You know, he's not the ideal hero like you get in a knight in a romance, you know, where it's the perfect hero. Yeah. He's a regular person. Yep. And he has fear and he has courage and he's well-rounded. I like him, even though you don't necessarily know a lot about him. He doesn't have much family and he's a, you know, a philologist and he teaches at a university or whatever, but he's, right. You know, you don't know much about him as with the details of his life, but you do get to know him and he's a good character. And especially in Paralandra, I really like him. In That Hideous Strength, he kind of takes a back seat in some ways to some of the other characters. But these two books are just about him, 100% right. The whole time.
Yeah.
So something else to mention is this book is not really science fiction. That's the dirty little secret that we have here.
Right.
It's interesting because this is held up as the golden standard of Christian sci-fi. But it's not really science fiction. The rocket ship is powered by solar radiations that haven't been discovered yet.
Right.
You know? And in Paralandra, it goes one step further, where he just gets into a box and angels carry him to Venus. But that's another discussion.
That's the way to do it.
But this is really more of a science fantasy. And, you know, by the time that he wrote this, they knew that there wasn't life on Mars. And they knew that the canals on Mars were not built by the Martians and everything like that. But...
Spoiler.
What do you mean, spoiler? Like, they discovered this. And we've known this for our entire life. What?
Now people who didn't know that, well, it'll be spoiled for them. They won't be able to find
this
out.
This is real life. You want to spoil real life for people, okay? Spoiler, if you walk in front of a moving vehicle, you're going to get hurt. Spoiler.
I mean, thanks. Now I can't find out for myself.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So, anyway, he wrote this knowing that what he was writing about on Mars wasn't really on Mars,
right.
But he didn't care because that wasn't the point of the book. The point of the book was not to like explore the what if of the science questions, was to explore the what if of the spirit questions.
Right.
Bringing us to something else that you need to kind of know about C.S. Lewis to get more out of this book and out of the whole series. He spent a lot of time in his personal life and in his professional life studying medieval literature, and he wrote about it. And one of my favorite books by him is one of those who cares books called The Discarded Image, which describes the medieval universe model. The medieval universe, it was an ordered universe. That's where we get the music of the spheres description of what the world was like. Right. Earth was at the center. Earth sat in the center. It was a globe in the middle of these other spheres. And in these other spheres, you had these layers of spheres. There were seven of them that were planets. And each planet was embedded in like a transparent sphere. And that was spinning around. And the final one, there had all the stars in it. And that was spinning around. And then you had the prime mover, which was basically the one that gets them all going in this cosmic dance. And you know, they call it the music of the spheres because it's got this rhythm and this movement there. And then beyond that,
some people still believe that too.
Yeah. And beyond that, you had heaven. And so in C.S. Lewis's writings here, he's writing about the solar system, not as Earth as the center of the universe, but he's actually giving kind of an inversion on the medieval model. In his book, Earth is not the center God is the center. It's a spiritual inversion of the physical medieval model. God is the center. Earth is on the outside looking in. Which, think about this for a second. When you are standing outside looking up at the stars, you are not looking away from Earth. You are looking toward the heavens.
Mm-hmm.
And leaving Earth, you don't leave Earth. You're not going out of Earth. You're going into the universe. And it's kind of turning, you know, like Steve already said about turning those other science fiction narratives of nasty, nasty creatures coming from other planets to destroy, or humanity visiting other planets and having to destroy the nasty, nasty creatures that are attacking them. But instead, it turns on its head and it's humans who are the invaders. He's kind of turning on its head this idea of the spiritual life of humanity. To C.S. Lewis, man filling the center of his life with his own self results in nothingness or hell, which is really, really strongly and visually portrayed in The Great Divorce.
Right.
It's an inside-out kind of philosophy. So instead of space being empty, space is full. Instead of monsters being ugly, these monsters are actually lovely. And right. Man is not the center. God is the center.
Mm-hmm.
That's another thing I just love about this book, is this idea. Now, you take this medieval model and take the fall of Satan, put them together, and what do you get? You get the silent planet. Earth is the bent planet, the planet with sin. And the story of Adam and Eve in Eden is why Earth is silent, because it's cut off from the rest of the universe.
Right.
So that's, again, some background there for you as you're reading this and kind of trying to understand what some of these things are that he's talking about. Now let's talk about his style here.
Well, it's interesting because when he's writing in the 1930s, and I mean, this is pre-Isaac Asimov, pre-Ray Bradbury. This is before the big boom in science fiction writing, and, you know, authors that have that you would recognize their name. It's a prototypical science fiction novel. It's not derivative of anything except the great, you know, the H.G. Wells, the fantastic ones that really stood the test of time and still do today. But you don't have him mimicking, you know, Murray Leinster or, you know, these other people who were writing at the time who just haven't had the continuance that other people have. And he really just takes it upon himself to craft this novel without having a lot of guidelines in his immediate range, in his, you know, in the maybe 10 years before he wrote this. You know, you're looking at pulp magazines, you're looking at amazing science fiction, you know, shorter stories, novellas and things like that, much more fantastic and things like that. At the same time, he's using some of those elements but creating something just in and of itself, you know, its own thing. So it's a fantastic.
Yeah, and it's definitely it's one of those world building type of things too. You haven't seen too many people just go out and describe another world that doesn't exist. And you can see that in H.G. Wells' First Man on the Moon. You can see that in Voyage to Arcturus. You can see that in John Carter, which I've just been reading a lot about because of the book that Daniel suggested on his blog with the Beyond Disney or the Between Disney blog. When he's writing this book, he's describing an alien landscape. He's describing an alien culture, a few different alien cultures. And he is really painting a picture unlike anything that people had seen before. I mean, it was just completely wild and new and interesting and serious, and not just the pulpy adventure. Although there is a little bit of pulpy adventure in it.
But not what you would, like, if you read the pulps, this would be something else.
No, and Ransom is kind of the anti-John Carter. I mean, John Carter comes, he shows up, and he's this hero who can jump, you know, he's the prototype for Superman. He can leap a, you know, tall building in a single bound because the gravity on Mars is less than it is on Earth. And he can, you know, defeat hordes and hordes of Martian, I can't remember what the creatures actually called on Mars in John Carter.
I know who you're talking about.
Well, he's killing lots of them.
Yeah.
To the point where, you know, he's just leaving piles of bodies in his wake. And with Ransom, he's not like that. He's a professor, you know. He studies language and he likes to hike. So the pulpy parts, I mean, there are creatures that pop up and there are, you know, short little bursts of fighting and that kind of thing. The other thing he's doing is he is writing it as a Christian, and he is writing this with some agendas behind it. Some people who read it kind of looked at it and said, this is an attack on science. He's attacking science because his main character, or his main villain, is Weston, who's a scientist. And his other main villain is Divine. He just wants money. You know, he's sinking money into this spaceship thing because he's going to bring back stuff that's going to get him more money. And they're kind of, you know, Weston and Divine are using each other to get there, and then they bring Ransom along as well, which I'm not going to explain why here, but Lewis didn't consider it to be an attack on science. He considered it an attack on scientism, which is kind of a populist belief that was popping up that's basically saying the human race must endure at any cost, and it's going to endure because of science. Science is going to make humanity immortal, and man has the right to dominate and to rule. This bringing us back to Olaf Stapledon and his book Last and First Men, which is something that C.S. Lewis wrote, or read rather, and inspired him to kind of respond to this scientism. In that book, you have the people, it follows just the people of humanity after nuclear devastation in like 1930 or something like that, and it follows their progression as they get into genetic manipulation and get into having to leave the Earth. So they go to Venus and they just commit complete and utter genocide, destroying the entire population of Venus and eventually becoming the one great, singular, you know, powerful, all mind type of people in, you know, that's so common in science fiction, that kind of star baby kind of thing from like 2001. I do have one more letter I wanted to read that C.S. Lewis was writing to Sister Penelope of the community of St. Mary the Virgin. And he wrote to her and said, "What set me about writing the book was the discovery that a pupil of mine took all that dream of interplanetary colonization quite seriously, and the realization that thousands of people in one form or another depend on some hope of perpetuating and improving the human species for the whole meaning of the universe, that a scientific hope of defeating death is a real rival to Christianity." And that, you know, that shows up. It's that idea, like I said, of, you know, when you're trying to fill yourself with yourself.
Right.
You know, you're not going to get anything. You're just going to have emptiness or hell. And he's right. It's all over all of his writings. And in this, it's in this trilogy as well, where he is fighting against that idea. Like he said, the scientific hope of defeating death is becoming a real rival to Christianity. So we've covered the universe that he was writing about. We've covered some of the things he was writing against. Oh, also one of the things he was writing against is the colonialism that colonizing space. He wasn't just looking at that and as a abstract like we would. He's looking at it as part of the British Empire and seeing what they have kind of become and kind of were doing with some of these places where they just took over and considered it their right.
Right.
One last thing, and I find this kind of ironic that he said this, but one of the things he was saying when he was writing Out of the Silent Planet, one of the reasons he wanted to was because he was finding in this scientific or this genre that he called scientification, that it unfortunately had too much science and too little fiction.
Okay, no, that's scientifiction.
Scientifiction, yeah, scientifiction.
That's what they called science fiction before they called it science fiction.
Right. And he called it that for a long time after they did. But he said there's too much science and too little fiction, which I find kind of, you know, in Out of the Silent Planet, he really, you know, addresses that by having almost no science. And what science there is kind of made up science. And the whole thing is fiction. So that brings us to the legacy of this book. And like I said, this book is held up as the gold standard of Christian science fiction, which it isn't really. It's Christian science fantasy. It's good, but it's not what people think it is. And a lot of people, when they are getting ready to read it, are thinking, oh, wow, the guy who wrote Narnia wrote science fiction? Wow, that's great. And they read it, and it's not what they're thinking.
Right.
So
it's not epic space, you know, fantasies, spaceships, light swords, you know, conquering dictators from an evil planet, you know, Hawkmen. It's not all that stuff.
But that brings us then to this question of why read it? Okay.
Right.
And I do believe if you are a fan of C.S. Lewis, you need to read it because you need to see some of where he's starting from. This leads into Narnia. I mean, the whole idea of Narnia being, what if Jesus were to appear to these animal people? What would it be like? And it would be Aslan. Well, it's the same kind of thing with Out of the Silent Planet, where it's, what if there are other worlds that are inhabited? And in Paralandra, he visits a world that is pre the decision to fall or not. It's pre the Eden decision that we failed.
Right.
And in Out of the Silent Planet, it's in a world where, you know, that character I mentioned in Voyage to Arcturus, who just brings death in his wake everywhere he goes. It's kind of similar to that, in that when the humans come, they aren't necessarily running around shooting everyone like the Martians in War of the Worlds, but they're bringing a little bit of human chaos. And it's very interesting to see how it all plays out. It's really interesting to see how it all plays out.
Right.
But Steve, what would you say if someone were to ask you, well, why should I read this book? What reason would I want to read a book written in 1930 something about a Mars that's not even real?
Well, I think for me, it's the it's his interesting take on, you know, an Edenic paradise that someone could actually go to. We don't have Eden here on planet Earth, you know, for whatever reason, wiped out by the flood or whatever. It's not there. We can't go to there.
Well, even before the flood, we couldn't go. It was protected.
Well, yes, but I mean, at least two people had come from it. So, you know, there was that. But here's something where we're thrust into it. And what would happen if we could go back? What would happen if we had, you know, the ability to go back and to, you know, at least taste it a little bit, to be there in that awesome presence of perfection? And here you have, you know, an interesting take on it because it's so foreign, you know, it's so alien. And I'm not just, you know, using the word in an alien planet sense. You need that to get to the point that he's making. You need that to understand what he's trying to tease out of that whole, you know, that whole thing. So I think if that sparks your imagination, if you say, wow, you know, an Edenic type of a paradise type of a thing, and an examination of of what perfection is in, you know, human, you know, looking at it as an alien. That's the wonder of it. That's where, to me, it gets you. If it doesn't touch you that way, then perhaps it's not your book. But still, you know, as a prototypical science fiction novel, as in a prototypical Lewis fiction,
mm-hmm.
it's interesting. You know, so those are three different things that I would say, if that grabs your imagination, then there you go.
Yeah. In some ways, it's a little bit unfortunate that he kind of stuck himself to that medieval universe, to that the music of the spheres there. He had to make it Mars because of that idea. Mm-hmm. And if it was another planet that wasn't Mars, that was in another solar system, it would be totally acceptable as a, you know, here's a possible world. And right. when you're reading this book, that's the thing, is he is describing to you another world. And yeah, there are some times where there's not a lot of action, you know, but there's so much description and it's so poetic in many ways. It's just a really, really well realized alien landscape where this affects that and that affects that. This group does this, which makes it possible for that group to do that. And you can see where the layers of the world are built upon each other. And it's a well, well realized world. And so I recommend it for that reason. I recommend it for the philosophy that you find it, and the theology that's in there. It gives you another perspective in some ways on the relationship between man and angels and God, which is another thing that he pulls in some ways from the medieval universe model, where you have this hierarchy of life. You right. have this kind of ladder that, you know, starts with inanimate objects, you know, which are at the bottom of the ladder. They have no life, you know. Then you have the beasts, you know. And I think when we were talking about the Christmas episode that we did, where Dr. Jace kept saying that animals have a soul with a little s, you know.
Right.
Then you have man. And so, in the sense of Out of the Silent Planet and Paralandra, you have the inhabitants of the planet would be included in that level of man. And then you have the angels, or the, I never figured out how to say the word, but Oyarsa. I know I'm just butchering that word.
Oyarsa, you got it.
Okay.
Try Fifeltriggy.
Yeah, or not. I'm just going to stick with Sorn. That's one of the creatures there too. You know, the Piffletriggy is one of the races on Mars, and the Sorns, and then the Hrasa. But is the Hrasa. The H is not silent. It's Hrasa. I think.
Pronounce it Hrasa.
Hrasa.
It's not its own syllable though. It's Hrasa.
Yeah. And then you have
Hrasa.
And so you have those as the man level, and then you have the angel level, and then you have the god level, and each level is, you know, serving a different purpose. But as you're getting closer to God, you're getting closer to what's meant to be. The angels and man are images of God, especially because they have soul with S, a capital S. Although right. angels are all soul, no physical presence, so to speak. Why was I saying that, though? Oh, that it's unfortunate that it has to be Mars, because it is such a well-realized world, and you've got the theology there as well, and you have these worldviews clashing against each other. You have, you know, the worldview of Weston, who's basically, he's saying, you know, we are going to do whatever it takes. We're, you know, this is our right to come here. And you have Divine, who's all about the greed and about bringing back the rocks and that kind of thing. And then you have Ransom, who, you know, he's just figuring out what this world is like, and what's going on. And you have this idea of the Bent Archon, who is an Oyarsa that had fallen and was now, you know, on the silent planet.
Yeah.
And just the perspective it gives you on the state of affairs for our world now, currently, in reality. There's just a lot of meat to it. It's not necessarily the easiest read, although it is a quicker read because it is a shorter book.
Right.
The other reason I would say you should read this book at least once is so that you can get to know Ransom, see his experiences on Mars. And then when you get to Paralandra, you can read one of C.S. Lewis's best books ever. Maybe they would fight with Till We Have Faces.
Yeah.
For which one is better. But it's a close fight between those two. One of my favorite books of all time. And again, it's fighting with Till We Have Faces for one of those top spots there. But you get to know Ransom, see his experiences on Mars, understand this world and how it works. And then when you go to Paralandra, you've got that right there for you. And it's a great, 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 great book. So that is our introduction to Out of the Silent Planet.
You're welcome.
I hope we haven't bored you too much with information dump. But before we go, we do need to open our hailing frequencies because we have some feedback. Hailing frequencies open. Shazbot, are you here, Shazbot? Welcome back, Shazbot, because you've been out to the shop, we'll say. How's that?
Yeah,
how's
nice that to sound? Have you back, buddy.
Welcome back. Glad to see you're feeling better.
What's up, everyone? It is good to be back in the house. Shazbot is back, baby, with a vengeance. Although, I follow the three laws of robotics, so vengeance is not really something I can do. But I'm back.
That's good. I'm glad to know that if I ever wrong you, you're not going to come after me.
Yeah.
And seek robot vengeance.
Robot vengeance.
We had some feedback about our Disney episode. And Shazbot, we also had some feedback for our Disney episode that you were unable to read for us because you were gone. And so would you share some of the Facebook comments that we've gotten here about our Disney episode?
Tom Holste said about the Disney episode, quote, in the middle of listening now, and loving it. Steve, how could you love Snow White / Cinderella / Sleeping Beauty and call the story for Little Mermaid horrible? It's cut from the exact same cloth.
No, it's hacked. The whole
grace and needing rescuing theme is identical. Except in this case, it actually makes more sense. Because she actually committed a sin that she needs grace for.
Yes, unquote.
Steve, he's taking you to task, man.
No, he's not.
Yes, he is.
Hacked, this is hacked out of the same cloth as the other three. It's not cut from it. It's like de-clothed, de-strung, de-threaded. It's taking this perfectly fine story, Hans Christian Andersen, and just turning it on its ear and then leaving it there for it to suffer ear damage. It was just horrible. And she doesn't get grace at the end. She gets permission to have done the other stuff because he grants her the wish that she wanted at the beginning.
I just like the message from The Little Mermaid that it gives to little girls, which is change yourself to the point of actually body transformation.
Yeah.
So that you can get your man to want you. You know?
Yeah. That's
get rid of that tail. Get some legs. Yeah. You know?
Because guys like legs.
Force yourself to become what he wants. Change yourself. Yeah. I probably am taking it a little extreme. But
no, that's exactly what they were going for.
If you pick too far at anything, you're going to have some problems. We also had a message from Travis Stacey Morrell, and I'm going to read his Shazbot. Sorry, but I'm going to read his right now. While he was listening to it, after he listened to it, he sent us a message and he said, great episode, although I might be a bit biased because I love the Disney animated movies. I was deployed to Kuwait back in 2010 and stuck working in the only recreation facility in the entire world that had a VHS player. So I got my parents to mail me all the old Disney VHSs we had. So for about 6 months, I watched a lot of the old classics like that. A lot of the people returning from Iraq and Afghanistan loved it, and I think a few of them used it as a form of readjustment therapy. So thank you, Travis, for sharing that with us. Yeah. I will say this. Travis, you sent us a challenge in our last episode where we were going to read feedback. You know, we were going to have Shazbot read feedback for people of what their favorite Disney movies were. And you issued your favorite. And I'm going to have Shazbot go ahead and read yours, Travis, because yours is going to be the hardest one that Shazbot has tackled to date. But unfortunately, Shazbot does not sing. He just has great rhythm. So here we go. This is Travis Daisy Morell's favorite Disney movie, which we already read in our last episode. But now, because Shazbot is back, he's going to read it for you.
And finally, because I missed it last time, Travis Daisy Morell said Robin Hood. Because it has Robin Hood and Little John walking through the forest, laughing back and forth at what the old man has to say. Reminiscing, this hyphen n single quote hyphen that in having such a good time, Ordelali, golly, what a day.
That's
I don't remember the single quote hyphen.
Yeah, in the song. I think that's something that's a flourish.
I think Shazbot kind of added that in. Whoops. Okay. But there you go. And, you know, we're going to have a greatest hits Shazbot album. Shazbot sings greatest Disney hits.
Yeah. A lot of good stuff off of that.
It's going to be a bootleg. So you can watch for the pirated version. Anyway, that is enough. I do hope you join us in reading Out of the Silent Planet. If you have not read this book yet, I recommend it. This is a foundational book in Christian literature. The 30s, you know, saw Out of the Silent Planet, and wasn't The Hobbit in the 30s as well?
Yep, definitely.
You know, and you had Charles Williams, and you had a bunch of different people like C.S. Lewis who were putting out very imaginative science fiction and fantasy. And this is a chance to kind of see where, especially if you are a Christian writer, but even if you're a Christian reader, to find out and see where we came from and what our heritage is. I will also say this. I am on a quest right now. I am on a quest to find out if Christian science fiction is really as bad as everyone says it is. A couple weeks ago, kind of had a moment, Steve, where I was listening to two different podcasts by Christians on the same day. These podcasts were not posted on the same day, but I happened to be listening to them on the same day, and both of them just trashed, in general, Christian sci-fi and fantasy.
Christian sci-fi, wow.
Just talking about how terrible it always is. It's always so bad. It's always horrible, you know, and I kind of bristled at it. The first person that was saying it, I was just kind of, okay, why are you don't have to, you know. And then I hear the second person, totally unrelated. I don't even know if these people know each other or not. And it's the same thing. And I'm just thinking to myself, this is becoming the kind of thing where I want to find out if this is really as true as people say it is. And I did explain on when I was on that homeschool podcast, Steve, I was talking about, he was asking me about Christian comics and how some of the ones he had seen, or most of the ones he had seen, weren't very good. And I have a theory about this. And I think that this kind of applies to Christian science fiction as well.
Yeah.
The ratio of good to bad doesn't change when you move from one subgroup to another. So when you look at mainstream comic books or mainstream science fiction, the ratio of the horrible stuff to the great stuff is the same as the ratio of horrible Christian fiction to great Christian fiction.
Right.
The reason you see more of the horrible Christian fiction is because there is less Christian fiction in general.
Right.
So you, let's say you're on a boat in the ocean looking down you're going to see the big fish and you're going to see the little fish, but you're not going to see as much of the little fish because you're looking at a much bigger section, a much bigger area. You're going to see the bigger ones because you're looking down at this huge landscape.
Right.
But if you're looking at a little pond, you're going to see everything because the footprint is smaller. And you're able to take in more, and you're going to see the little fish and the big fish. You're going to see the bad fish and the good fish, the red fish and blue fish, the one fish, the two fish.
The two fish.
I think that that's what's happening.
Yeah.
And that's my theory about why this basically cliche has come up of Christian fiction is terrible. It's always terrible. And so I'm looking for good stuff. And I have some people who sent me... I have a book called The Wind Merchant that I'm going to be reading. I have a book called The Flight of the Angels that I'm going to be reading that was sent to me by some listeners. I have a book that I found in my old library called The Fallen, which is a really old sci-fi book. I have a couple of Stephen Lawhead's sci-fi, The Dream Thief and The Empyrean. No. Yeah, Empyrean.
Empyrean, yeah.
There's two books in that series. And I'm reading them or going to be reading them. After I finish Out of the Silent Planet, I'm just about done with that. Because I just want to find out, is it true? Because I don't think it is. I think that there's some really good stuff out there. But this is the legacy we're talking about. I mean, we're looking at the beginning of things with Out of the Silent Planet. And is it true that Out of the Silent Planet just birthed Drek? you know, 70 years later? 80 years later, 70 years later, I'm doing bad math. No, 80 years later. It doesn't matter. My math is bad if I'm going to be bouncing back and forth like this. But the point is this what C.S. Lewis birthed, you know? And I know that it seems like Christian fantasy seems to be getting it better than Christian science fiction. But I'm like I said, I'm looking, I'm specifically on a quest for sci-fi. Christian sci-fi.
Right. So not, send it.
Not the sci-fi send Christian, it. But Christian sci-fi. So if you are listening and you have any suggestions, or especially if you're an author and you've written some, I would love to see it. But that's my quest.
Very cool.
All right. Steve, any last words?
That's all of them.
Okay, great. Then would you like to say goodbye?
Have a good everything, people and stuff. I got a huge blizzard coming in tomorrow, so, you know. When you get this, I might be buried, but at least you'll have this as a little capsule of my last few minutes here on Earth.
Well, I know I'm not going to get this up on Thursday. It'll probably be tomorrow that it gets posted, and especially with some of the editing to do.
Right.
Told you. My All goal right. was to not have any editing, but
close.
I was wrong.
Close.
All right. We'll talk to you later, Steve.
All right. God bless you, man.
Godspeed, everyone.
This was the Strangers and Aliens podcast with Ben Avery, Dr. Jace O'Neill, and Stephen MacDonald. Our music was written, recorded, and mixed by Tim Leffel. Visit our website, www.strangersandaliens.com, where we have reviews, articles, and links. We want to hear from you. Find us on Facebook, facebook.com/strangersandaliens, or on Twitter, where we are under the name Strange and Alien. You can contact us through our website by writing a message or leaving us a voicemail using your computer's microphone, or emailing us at podcast@strangersandaliens.com. Finally, you can call us and leave a message. Our number is 1-840-37-ALIEN. That's 1-840-372-5436. Thank you for listening.
Image. It's the first Men in the Moon from 1901, I think it was.
Okay.
And it's actually, we're going to talk about the specifics, but what was that?
Looks like someone came onto Skype.
Yeah. Oh, it's Matt Anderson. Hey. Should I send him a message?
Yeah.
Instant I'll message.
From the B team.
Hey, Matt. talking about Out of the Silent Planet right now for our next episode. Let's see if he says anything. Ah, Matt says, nice. I just started it. Great. This cool. episode is an introduction to the book. No spoilers. Let's see what he has to say.
All right.
He's replying, oh, good. I can listen to it then. Yes. Yes, you can. Oh, he's going to say something else. Tell your listeners hello from the Sci-Fi Christian.
Oh,
this will probably go after the end credits because I forgot to turn off my volume. And when you came online, I foolishly had it beep into my microphone. Turning off the volume. Wait. Off the volume now. Peace. All right. So, let's get back into the conversation. And this is where it's going to fade out after the end credits.
Yeah.